I'm Joss Stone. Thanks for joining me for A Cup of Happy. I spent the last few years singing my songs in every country in the world and been lucky enough to meet incredible people from all walks of life. What really struck me is that no matter where we are, we're all on the same mission. We're all just trying to find our version of happy. So with this podcast, I'm going to be speaking to a whole host of people to dig deeper into the what, why, and how of this emotion we call happiness. I hope that with these conversations, you discover something to help you on your own quest for happiness, possibly change your mind on a few things, and along the way, share a good old laugh with me and my guests. Today's guest is none other than my dad. I thought many of you might be interested to learn a little bit about how I came to think the way I do. Although often on this podcast, it's more about how my learned guests think, as that seems a little bit more important when most of them study happiness. My dad has been one of my heroes with regard to how to live your life. He was a yin to my mum's yang. You all know me, I sing about love, I burn joss sticks, I throw sunflowers at crowds. But there is another side to me that certainly came from the balance that we had at home. My dad brought that other side in a very clear and deliberate way. He's a sweetheart, but also a bit of a savage. Listening to our wonderful group of pods has led me to realise that we need to bring this balance to A Cup of Happy. Not everyone is the same, but everyone deserves to be happy. So Dad and I talk about the drama of getting me out of my evil record deal when I was a kid. Oh, bless his heart. It must have been difficult. His trademark third quarter theory and the only three choices that any of us have in life. Here's my dad. When you climbed up the mountain in Nepal, was that before kids?
Yeah.
So last time I was chatting about that, you were saying something about, oh, I got to the top of the mountain and I thought, what the hell am I doing here?
Yeah.
Tell me about that, because a lot of people that listen to the podcast and people that have been on this podcast will talk about how important it is to spend time with you and you alone and to, you know, be in nature and really breathe in life and really be in the moment. And climbing up a mountain in Nepal is a dream for a lot of people in order to walk towards happiness. But for you, it was actually a bit of a hindrance?
If somebody has a dream to climb a mountain, then they should climb a mountain. No question at all, number one. Number two, I'm very comfortable being on my own. Very, very comfortable being on my own. I like it. I especially like being alone when I go to my boat. Well, I haven't got a boat at the moment. I'm boatless, which is a bit of sadness, but nothing to get too depressed about. but I really like going down to my boat and just being there on my own, having a beer, sparking up a naughty cigar and just being there. You know, I love that. But Nepal, I had a bit of a realization, because I've been having lots of fun for about 4 years. I've been hitchhiking around the world. I've been into mostly Europe, North Africa, worked as a, you know, odd jobs in Gibraltar and done a bit of sailing. And they were all things which gratified only me. I wasn't making a contribution at all, apart from to the benefit of Richard Stoker. And I got to that mountain. I mean, I wasn't high. I was just on a mountain. I wasn't high up either. I was just on a mountain. It wasn't a particularly high mountain. It just happened to be a ridge.
I thought, a mountain in Nepal, yeah.
I thought, what am I doing up here? I'm just basically pleasing myself and I'm not making any contribution. And I thought, this is not the way to live your life. I was the grand old age of 21. I thought, I'm not really making any contribution here. And actually, making a contribution is another thing which I think makes us happy, makes us feel fulfilled. You know, I like to give. Mm-hmm. It makes me feel good. And not just to give, but also to provide. So I've got got fulfillment and still do by, in the early days, providing for my family, and then subsequently providing for the broader, the wider family. But also, I enjoy running a business. I enjoy providing employment for people. Mm-hmm. I quite like looking out the window, looking at the car park and thinking, all these people are driving to work because I'm giving them a function, and that pays their rent, which supports their family, and then they bring up families, and that's all good. I mean, it's a small business, so it's in a small way, and it could probably be bigger.
But to some people, it's huge.
Well, it's not. It's a tiny business.
Well, how many boxes of fruit did you start with?
Six.
And how many boxes of fruit do you have now? Two factories full of the stuff.
Yeah. 6,000
so
tons.
I would say it's pretty big in comparison to those six boxes. So have you heard of the abundance mindset?
No.
It's a Tony Robbins thing, I think. So we have a quote. I think it's from Tony himself. An abundance mindset is the belief that there are enough resources in the world for everyone, and of being grateful for whatever the universe provides. Now,
I'll go with the first half.
The first half, yeah. Don't talk about universe to my dad, people. He'll just turn right off. don't talk about spirituality or universes. Okay, but let's just focus on what it's saying. So the reason why we were discussing that this morning, Rich and I, is because I said to him, you know, when we were kids, we didn't know that we weren't the richest people in the world. You know, we didn't know that there was any type of struggle going on monetarily. Oof. We didn't know, because we were children, and you guys, you and mum, both managed to not let us know. And I think that allowed us to have the abundance mindset. So okay. I feel like anything, I genuinely feel that anything is possible if you put your mind to it. I believe that because of the way that we were brought up. We lived in a terrace house in Dover with how many lodgers? So many lodgers. Oh. One of them was a murderer, ended up killing someone. The other one was a pervert that you had to kick out. Mum was cooking for, she was cooking for how many people, I don't know, when she was in labour with me, all to pay this mortgage.
Yeah.
What was that like, Dad? You had to fill your house with all these people in order to cover it. And now your world is very different. So you've changed your stars. What was it like back then? Because I was there, but I wasn't aware.
Ugh, it's a long time ago.
I'm not that old.
It was fine. I mean, we had to do what we needed to do. I've never said, whenever I've been on the bones of my ass, which I have been more than once, I've never said I must cut back. I've always said, I've got to earn more money. I need more money.
I must do
more.
How
am I going to earn more money? Cutting back just hasn't been part of my, and still isn't, part of my mindset. Mm. Sometimes you have to think a little bit carefully before you do something that's going to have financial implications. Otherwise, you end up in trouble. But, so in those days, it was like, right, house. I had a young family, more on the way, not much income, knew we wanted to get onto the property ladder. Wendy was having babies, so she wasn't working. My business was, pathetic, really, compared to, you know, what we do now. But, I mean, it was fledgling. I didn't earn much money. I was just starting. I had a market stall, for crying out loud. So that was what we needed to do. So we did that. And then we did have a bit of trouble with a couple of them. But I can be quite an imposing figure, I suppose. One guy, I don't know if I can tell this story, but...
It's all right. It's my podcast. I can cut it out if you want.
Okay. So we had some neighbours, and the woman was French. And we pulled up with you kids in the car. And we're just getting out of the car. Hi there. Hello. And then this woman came over to me. Can't remember her name. It's a million years ago. And said, Richard, I must tell you something. Your lodger is masturbating at the window. Have you not heard this, Joss?
Oh, my God.
I said, what? I said, are you sure? She said, yeah, I was hanging out the washing.
Oh, my God.
And your lodger was masturbating at the window. I said, okay, I'll sort it out. So I walked in, went into his room. I think I knocked. And I just looked at him and I said, you, out, now. And he just looked at me and I walked out the room. 20 minutes later, I can see her in the back garden, so I went out and she said, what are you going to do about it? You know, are you going to do anything about it? I said, he's gone.
He left?
Gone. Picked up his bags and went.
Didn't even argue?
Didn't say a word. Just looked at me and knew exactly.
God.
He just knew exactly.
Why couldn't he just shut the bloody blinds and be, you know, like a normal bloke? Get a magazine, you weirdo.
He was getting the attention of the woman.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's awful. And I had this person in my house. So, yeah, there is a risk, I suppose, in taking in lodgers because you don't know who they are.
Yes, you don't know who they are. They're not. True they weren't story. Background checked. I mean, you know, you started your life in a different way than how you're living it now. So the point is, the reason why I bring these things up is because your world has changed. You no longer have to have lodgers that are a danger to your children. You no longer have to do any of that because, you know, look, here I'm talking to you. You are talking to me from Dubai in an apartment that is yours. You are playing golf because you love it. You have your own business. I don't know what's going on with the boat, but it's a very different world to the stories that I heard of from when we were tiny babies. And I believe that people can change their stars. And I believe that you are an example of that.
I think I'm not.
I know you think you're not, but I think you are. And I see it from my perspective, but I would love for you to tell me why, even though you're the one doing it.
Right. I'll explain it to you. I'm not a Labour supporter, Labour UK political party, but there was the Deputy Prime Minister, John Prescott. He actually punched a protester. A protester threw an egg at him and he punched him. I mean, he's a hero.
Oh, my God.
Anyway.
I don't know this
story. Oh, you've got to look it up on YouTube. John Prescott, egg, right hand. They used to nickname him Two Jags Prescott. The media criticised him because he had two Jags, Jaguar motor cars.
Oh, okay.
And Two Jags Prescott, as I like to call him, said, I'm a working class lad living a middle class life.
Yeah.
Now, I've had debates with Lucy about this and I lose because clearly my family are middle class and I suppose I am in a way. But
you are now.
Well, don't know if a leopard can change his spots in terms of class. I think you are the class you're born into. But I was born into a family where my dad had his own business. They had their own shop. So lower.
You were already middle class.
Lower middle class, perhaps. But with a very, you know, with a good work ethic. And back in the day, we were talking about when you were kids and when we had lodgers and had to pay the mortgage. You know, I had a market stall. So I used to get my produce, go to the market, set out my stall, give people value, and that's pretty much what I still do. I go and get my produce. It's a little bit further away. You know, it's Pakistan or Sri Lanka or Vietnam, and I prepare it, and I take it to market. So it's very similar. I haven't really changed what I do. I just do it in a bigger way.
How many people did you employ back then?
One. Me.
And how many people do you employ now?
30 or 40.
How's the stress levels comparison to that then and now? Was it more stressful then?
Not always. Sometimes it was, if you thought that you couldn't pay the bills. But then sometimes, you know, Western Commodities is 25 years old on March the 2nd next year, 2023. Mm. There have been times where I've thought, I'm going to run out of money. There have been times when I've had contractual disputes, when I've thought, this is a bit, you know, this is this is squeaky bum time.
I remember there was a conversation that we had, I don't know how many years ago now, maybe 7 years ago. I said to you, Dad, why do people work? Is it so they can work more or so they can also play? And then all of a sudden, it was like the next week, you decided to have as many holidays and play as much golf and do as much fun things as you possibly could. It was like there was this switch. You decided, God, I need to play more. Is that something that you consciously did?
I can tell you exactly when it was. And unfortunately, I can't allow you to take the credit. It was as I approached 50.
Oh, it was your age.
And as I approached 50, I thought, I've definitely got less time ahead of me than I've just had. And that's when I coined my third quarter theory, which is people quite like this. And this really is original thought. When I went from 49 into 50, I thought, well, this is the third quarter. If you're going to split it up into 25 year sections, you know, who gets to 100? Not many, but let's see. Then this is the third quarter. And the third quarter is the quarter before the rocking chair quarter. So 75 and on, 80 and on, that's when you're going to be telling the stories. You're not going to be necessarily generating the stories. So in your third quarter, you've still got your health, you've still got all your faculties. You may, if you're lucky, if you've been fortunate and worked hard and done all the right things, you may have a bit of disposable income, which I had all of those. I just needed to make sure that I could generate some free time. And so that's what I did. And I just made a conscious decision. I was going to live my third quarter. Because your first quarter is a nonsense. You're a child, you're a teenager.
It's a nonsense.
It's just a mess, isn't it? The second quarter, that's like parental emergency, family, mortgage, blah, 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 blah. You know, bringing up kids. And then because I started early, by the time I got to 50, you were all grown and flown. Because, you know, we had Lucy when I was 21 or 22. So by the time I'm 25, that's it. My baby-making job was done. So done. By the time I was 50, Harry must have been 25.
See, you speak about the parental emergency. You know, before I had Violet, I was like, okay, well, I'll live wherever I want. It's all good. I'll just move around. I'll be nomadic. It'll be fine. And then I got to about 7 months pregnant with her and I was like, oh, I think we need to find somewhere to live, love. Like, actually, you know, it's you can't just carry on as you were because the kids need stability.
And curiously, you use the word nomadic. But that's what I'm doing now because I don't have...
Yes, so you've gone back.
I've gone back to a nomadic existence where I'm a few months here, a few months there and a few months somewhere else. But I couldn't do that if I had kids.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so people know me for a few different things, mostly, you know, singing songs. But if people have been following my music since I was little, they may have heard about the time that I left EMI. Because that was a bit of a drama, slightly. It's a little bit of a drama. Now, Dad, they don't know that you were the one that negotiated that deal.
I can't believe you're going to ask this question. You're going to get me to talk about the only thing that you and I disagree on that we don't talk about. I thought this podcast was supposed to be called Cuppa Happy, not Cuppa Contractual Disputes.
No. There is a happiness aspect to it. Oh. So this is the point. We have to go through trials and tribulations in order to get towards happiness. Now, when I decided, oh, you know what, Dad? Thanks very much for sorting me out that deal that's worth 10 million quid. But actually, I don't like these people and I'm not feeling very happy. Right? And you had taught your daughter to believe that you don't have to do anything if you don't want to do it. You used to tell me that all the time. Yep. You don't have to do anything.
Correct.
Which is something that all young people should be taught by their parents, especially young girls, for lots of different reasons. But I would go into my high school and talk to my head of the school and tell him, I don't have to do anything. you cannot tell me. I literally have implemented this into my life in loads of different ways with as much politeness as I possibly can. But anyway, so then I get to, I don't know how old I was, 18, because we renegotiate the deal when I turn 18.
Yeah, we did.
Because you knew, Joss, you sign this deal when you're 14, when you're 18, you get to renegotiate. And then I signed a 5-album deal. I just followed your lead. And then I realized a few years later, all of the people that had signed me and had been with me left that company. So I became extremely unhappy with people that were just, I considered them total assholes. They weren't supportive of me. They weren't kind. All sorts was going on. Anyway, for whatever reason, I decided I don't have to do anything. That's what my dad told me. And he was right.
So my fault then.
Yes, it's totally your fault. But I have to say it's the best decision I've ever made. But it took a long time for that to happen because I had to beg them to let me go. And I remember talking to you on the phone on my tour bus and you were like, Joss, it's so much money. You know, it's something that you could just, you know, do. And the conversation went on for a while. But in the end, I said to you, I'm not happy doing this. And you turned around and said, okay, then I'll support you.
Which I did.
Which you did. And that was huge. And my life got so much better. I did the world tour because of that. I wouldn't have been able to do the world tour without being able to leave that scenario. But my question, how does that feel as a dad? You know, you've worked your ass off your entire life and you've given your kids everything. And then you have to stand by when one of them's going, do you know what? I don't want those millions of pounds. Thanks. No, I'm good.
Right. Okay. So the first thing is that you'd fired me and your mother. You told everyone that they weren't allowed to speak to us. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yes. I was like, you are going to talk to me. I was managing myself, yeah. Wasn't I? And I still do. And I'm still not very good at it.
In between time, you still had me hiring managers, firing managers, hiring agents. I was supposed to be fired, but I was still doing all that shit. And then it was actually me and you who hired Merck, and it was...
No one knows this story. We're going to have to just tell them. Merck is a manager that worked with Macy Gray,
yeah,
wasn't he?
He was.
If people, Merck, you know, don't know Merck. He was one of the 5 managers that I had.
The last.
I'm unmanageable, and I did not get along well with
any of them.
Being told what to do or having people make decisions for me. So anyway, go on. Yes, Merck.
So I was supposed to be out of the picture. No one was supposed to talk to me. Richard Bray...
My lawyer, by the way, everyone.
Fantastic lawyer.
He was my lawyer.
Great guy. He flew over to New York.
Sweetest guy in the world.
He flew over to New York, and I flew over to New York, and I wasn't supposed to be involved. And I paid my own way.
God, I don't remember any of this.
Oh, because you don't know, I don't think, because I don't think I've ever told you this.
I don't remember.
I paid my own flight and my own hotel, and Merck and Richard would go into EMI every day, do negotiations, they'd come out, we'd meet in the pub, we'd meet in the bar, we'd meet in the hotel, and we'd like strategize what we were going to do the next day. And then I'd sit back and they'd go in and they'd come back out. And then that went on for about 3 days while we put that deal together.
Dad, are you talking about the deal, the record deal, not the exit?
I'm talking about the record deal. Because
the record deal.
Because
okay,
you said that I'd negotiated that deal. Well, I didn't. So credit where credit's due. Then,
okay, yeah,
then
yeah.
You wanted to get out of it. And I said, Joss, it's $10.6 million, love. Sort yourself out. And you said, no, Dad, I'm not happy. And I said, right, I will support you. And that's when I actively engaged, with your blessing, in the negotiations to get you out of that deal.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate thing was that whilst we, the lawyers, the managers, everybody, we're on conference call after conference call, trying to strategize and work out how we were going to get you out of the deal. whilst retaining some money for you. You walked into EMI and said, take the money back. And for the record on your podcast, Cup of Happy, you returned $9.6 million that was in the escrow account.
And some.
And a royalty on...
two records afterwards, yeah.
Which was the worst negotiated deal in history.
In the history of deals, yeah, it was pretty bad.
And it was awful. And I was...
But it took...
Stupidity. You were going to say courage.
No, not courage. It took too many years. It took too long. I didn't deserve anything.
Oh, yes, you did.
No, I wasn't going to make them any more records. I just didn't want anything to do with them. If I'd have taken anything, then I would have had guilt. I don't want it. But yeah, no, the question really was not the detail. The question was, must be hard to watch your kids making what you consider to be mistakes over and over again. But you have to watch it. You have to see that happen. You've had three, actually four children, because you took on Dan, who is not your biological child, but you brought him up.
I've watched him make a few mistakes.
Yeah, we've all made mistakes. And you, as a parent, have to kind of sit by and watch that. And I'm going to have to do that with Violet and my little man that's coming, you know. How do you, if you were to give any advice to a parent, how do you survive that without going completely mad?
Take a deep breath, count to 10, and support your children.
Yeah, you have to. So there are a lot of Richard-isms that we have in our family. One of them is play to your strengths. Yeah. The other one was that you said to me when I was a little girl, there's two things in life that you have to know, Joss, and you have to remember. And if you forget everything else, it doesn't matter. One, life's not fair.
Yep.
Two, no one loves you more than your dad. And I thought that was sweet. So I'm taking that one on. I'm giving that one to Violet for sure. Life's not fair. No one loves you more than your mum. Now, my favourite Richardism, though, is the three choices. And this is something that the way you word it is up to you. And the way you particularly word it, Dad, makes people, like, the hairs on the back of their neck go up, and then they get like a bit moody with it because it's harsh, slightly harsh wording. But there are different ways you can say it. So I believe that it is, and correct me if I'm wrong, put up and shut up, change it or get out.
That's it.
There's no sugarcoating. There's no sugarcoating on any of that. Those are your three choices in life. And I have asked people to come up with a fourth. I am still trying to come up with a fourth, and they can't really.
Nope. So let me just, for your cup of happy people, let me just explain. You can apply it to all different aspects of life. It could be a relationship that you're in. It could be a job that you're in, where you live. Maybe you've got a problem with your neighbours. Maybe you've got a problem with your partner, your spouse. Maybe you've got a problem with your boss or your work colleagues. But of the three choices, the first choice you can make is to put up and shut up and just go along with it. That's not a recipe for happiness, but sometimes it's a strategy that may, you know, give it a bit of time. You know, maybe mm-hmm. it'll work itself out, you know. So for a time, it's not something that you can never do, but sometimes it's the right thing to do. I'm just going to put up and shut up and see how this works out.
Yeah.
You don't pose the three choice question to a problem until you've already done the put up and shut up. So by the time you get round to asking yourself, what am I going to do about this? It's serious. You know, am I going to leave my job? Am I going to leave a relationship? Am I going to move house? You've already gone past number one. So
yeah.
In terms of this thought process, you never really consider number one as an option because you've already done it or been doing it. You might have been doing it for years. So then you've got the other two choices, which are change it or get out. And the change it is, well, what can I do in this situation? Can my relationship become better if I work at it? Can I get the neighbours on side? Is there something I can do? Can I do better at my job? Can I shoot my boss? Can I, you know?
There are things you can do.
And mm-hmm. you can give that a little bit of time as well.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, it's usually time to get out, because otherwise you will remain unhappy.
That's right.
So I think change, if you can change, that's good. But often it's time to get out. And, you know, as I said right at the start of this, defining happiness is difficult. And people have been trying to do it for centuries. But actually, you can, I think, more easily define what constitutes and contributes to stress and drama and anxiety in your life. And if you can get rid of those, you are on your way. You are on your way to a better life, surrounded by people who you connect with, in better relationships, a better job, better money, bigger boats, more cars, faster motorbikes.
and
obviously lots of grandchildren, you know.
Yeah.
All the things that make you happy.
What great advice. Thank you so much, Dad. You've been brilliant.
Okay, Joss. Bye, darling.
Hi, my name is Kay Adams, and to be honest, I'm not so good with the aging process, so I enlisted my old chum, the filter-free Cara McKenzie, to advise.
Could you imagine being a porn star? The room would need to be really hot for me to strip off.
To be honest, she's not much help, but she is rather amusing. And along with some great guests, Joe Brand, Andy Oliver, Anton Dubek, Ruth Langsford, and Craig Revel Horwood, darling, we are learning how to be 60. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.